Today we have Jim Jaeger. Jim is finishing his second year, fourth year, at Meadville Lombard School of Theology in Chicago. And he's been doing this on a part-time basis. He still is in practice as a lawyer here in Madison. And to be able to combine all of that is a huge commitment of time management and also reflection on what it means to be part of our UU movement. Jim is going to be discussing who is my neighbor, moral dimensions of public policy. And we are delighted to have Jim Jaeger present this morning. Jim.
Thank you very much. Usually people wait till the end to decide whether to applaud or not. It's very good to be here this morning. I've been here at Prairie in different functions at different times, and it's always a delight to get back together to see many old friends and to make new ones. To begin my comments this morning, I want to read from the Christian tradition, from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 10, verses 25 through 37. I suspect this is a piece many of you will recognize. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" Jesus replied. "How do you read it?" And the questioner answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "You've answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." But he wanted to justify himself, and so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And in reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell in the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down that same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came to where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have.' Now, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" The expert in the law replied, "Well, of course, the one who had mercy on him." And Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." If Nikki White had been a resident of any other rich country, she would be alive today. With these stark words, retired New York Times reporter T.R. Reid begins his book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Monique A. Nikki White was a young woman who contracted lupus shortly after she graduated from college. As the disease got worse, she was unable to work. Having lost her employment, she lost her insurance. Until she was determined to be disabled, she did not qualify for any of our public health care plans. Not having insurance, she was unable to afford the treatment she needed. By the time she was eligible for existing public health benefits, it was too late, and she died. Nikki didn't die from lupus, her doctor told Reid. Nikki died from complications of the failing American healthcare system. It was a lack of access to healthcare that killed Nikki White. For Reid, Nikki's situation is emblematic of the fundamental moral decision regarding healthcare that we've made in the United States. Until recently, we chose not to provide universal healthcare coverage to the citizens and residents of our country. We chose to allow over 40 million Americans go without the means to pay for adequate health care. And while we have passed a version of health care reform, many in our society are still unwilling to accept that decision. The results of that failure have had very real impacts on people's lives. Each year, an estimated 20,000 people die because they lack health insurance and are unable to pay for the necessary health care to prevent their deaths. Countless others are forced into bankruptcy because of large unpaid medical bills. For Reed, this is a moral failure of the United States. All of the other developed countries in the world have made a different moral choice, the choice to provide universal coverage. Not that these systems are without fault. Reed's book details problems that are faced by all healthcare systems. But in the other developed nations, the fundamental choice to cover all persons has been made. Yet, in our own healthcare debate, while we have looked at the economic benefits and detriments of universal coverage, examined many of the fine points of healthcare policy, and debated some of the sillier distortions of the proposals, such as claims of socialized medicine and roving death panels of government bureaucrats, we have paid very little attention to the moral dimensions of the debate. As a friend of mine once put it, in most countries, they made the moral decision to provide universal coverage and then figured out the best way to do it. In the United States, we ignored the moral question and argued over the details from the beginning. We have still not made the fundamental moral choice. Why is universal coverage a touchstone of moral decision-making in the healthcare debate? It's really a matter of fundamental fairness. To put it bluntly, it is often a question of who lives and who dies. One major factor is the inequitable distribution of wealth that controls access to healthcare coverage. So today I want to explore the question of how moral decision-making applies to public policy decisions in general and the current debate over health insurance reform in particular. Now, this discussion begins with a broader fundamental question. What is the appropriate role of moral and ethical analysis in making public policy? And for those of us who may ground our ethics and morals in religious and spiritual teachings, what is the proper role of these teachings in our public policy analysis? Most public policy decisions have a moral and ethical element. Since public resources are limited, decision-making is about making choices. Money spent for a B-1 bomber or a nuclear attack submarine is not available to build schools or hospitals. Money taxed by the government is not available for private consumption. Determining a level of income that defines poverty, upon which so many public benefits depend, is a choice. When we make choices, we have to have some basis. If we decide that a bomber is more important than a school, or a hospital is more important than an attack submarine, we are making moral choices, choices based on values. The question is not whether values are involved in the decision. It is what values are applied. One whose values are that the job of government is to defend the shores will vote for the bomber or the attack submarine, while one who believes that the job of government is to educate children or care for the sick will opt in favor of the hospital or the school. Neither decision is value neutral. What are the sources of moral and ethical decision making? Well, there are a number of them. A major source for many of us is religious belief. Basing ethical teachings on religious teachings has a long history. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, for example, Hebrew and Christian Bible teachings of the love of God and love of our neighbor are still seen by many as the indispensable touchstone of ethics. Yet in a country where separation of church and state is recognized as a fundamental value, to what extent should one's personal religious beliefs affect public policy decisions? In recent political campaigns, Roman Catholic office holders who support a woman's right to reproductive choice have been challenged by the Catholic Church leaders to bring their public policy positions into line with the official teachings of the church. Now, for a private individual, this may not be such a big problem, since the individual can make decisions and choose leaders based on personal ethical preferences. On the other hand, the individual who has chosen public service or political office as a career may have a broader obligation to balance personal moral preferences with notions of the wider public good. Does that mean that the public official or politician ethically needs to leave personal moral beliefs at the door when it comes to addressing broader public policies? That may be difficult to do. The politician or public official may argue that personal moral beliefs are at the core of who the individual is, and that one is required to follow those beliefs in making policy decisions. Yet, there is a fine line between making public policy decisions based on one's own moral code and imposing that code on others with whom one disagrees. The abortion debate is an excellent example of that. Even though one may believe that life begins at conception, basing public policy on that notion, which some consider to be scientifically or philosophically debatable, and imposing that view on others who disagree with you by passing legislation binding on all is to many unacceptable. Now, of course, that's also a moral judgment, determining that to be unacceptable, which many may disagree with. In recent years, many have been troubled by the actions of religious militants, whether they're Islamic jihadists, radical Christian fundamentalists, or others whose particular brand of religion we dislike and disagree with. Yet, for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, Thich Nhat Hanh, and others, their public work for justice was strongly influenced by their personal moral codes, which in turn were directly and strongly influenced by their religious beliefs. We liberals cheer them on, whereas in their time, their conservative opponents suggested that religion had no place in advocacy for civil rights or independence or against war. Now, while I could probably try to make an argument that there's a qualitative difference between the advocacy of Dr. King and, for example, Randall Terry, I wonder how much the argument is actually influenced by the fact that I agree with Dr. King and disagree with Terry. All of the world's religions provide a basis for moral and ethical analysis. Our reading for today, the familiar story of the Good Samaritan, is an example from the Christian and Jewish traditions. After acknowledging that the central requirement of the Jewish faith is the love of God and the love of the neighbor, Jesus is challenged by a listener to identify who the neighbor is. Jesus responds with the familiar story of the man traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho who is set upon by robbers and left for dead. After being ignored by the priest and the Levite, a Samaritan, a despised other in early first century Palestinian society, stops and treats the man, takes him to an inn, and yes, pays for his care. Jesus instructs the listeners to go and do likewise. This, as well as other well-known teachings of Jesus, raises the moral imperative for us to care for the least of these, our fellow creatures. Think about how these teachings of Jesus are directly relevant to the current healthcare debate. And think about how many times they have been quoted, whether in the White House or the halls of Congress, in connection with the calls for universal health care coverage. Teachings from other religious traditions provide a similar basis for moral decision making. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist teacher and activist, proposes a doctrine that he calls interbeing, the interconnectedness of all things, of all beings, and moral obligations arriving out of such interconnectedness. One of the five pillars of Islam is the requirement to pay zakat, or alms, for the poor. More broadly defined, zakat suggests a broader obligation to the poor and outcasts of society. In seeking a theological grounding for personal and public moral and ethical decisions, Unitarian Universalists, of course, are often drawn to the principles and purposes. In particular, the first principle, promoting the worth and dignity of each individual, and the seventh, which highlights our interconnectedness with all other beings. These two principles help us define how to treat one another in a way that we define as ethical. Now, resort to these two expressions of value is particularly relevant in the current healthcare debate. The first principle challenges us to make providing health care coverage to each individual a matter of fundamental human rights. The seventh principle reflects our sense of collective responsibility for one another. As a nation, we have a responsibility to all within our borders to ensure that they are cared for in their time of illness and pain without the fear of economic catastrophe for themselves or their families. Looking to both of these principles can help us form a coherent theological basis for an ethical stance. Yet, these two principles, one privileging individualism and the other promoting community, can also raise ethical dilemmas which are highlighted in the present debate over healthcare reform. One pervasive undercurrent of opposition to providing universal coverage is the implication that the cost of providing coverage to those who do not have it will be an undue burden on the rest of us who already have insurance. In other words, those of us who have coverage might lose something, so that the 40 million or so without coverage won't have to do without. Or we might have to pay more, either in premiums or taxes, so that others might be covered. Or bringing more people into the system will overburden it, causing us to lose a level of access to health care to which we have become accustomed. Now, our leaders have tried to assure us that those of us who have coverage will be able to keep it, and that the cost of paying for coverage for others will be borne by the unspecified rich or those with the so-called Cadillac plans. No politician, including, frankly, the president, is willing to ask that we middle-class folks sacrifice something for the greater good. Rather, to make the program politically palatable, no demands can be made on the rest of us. Some vaguely defined other must bear the burden, or we will do nothing at all. A similar ethical problem is posed by the debate over rationing and death panels. One of the challenges to healthcare planners is the amount paid for care at or near the end of life. Studies show that 27% of Medicare expenditures, almost $28,000 per patient in 2002, are spent in the last year of life. And over one-third of those expenditures come in the last month. All of us, I'm certain, have seen examples of this, where hopelessly ill elderly patients were subjected to treatments in the last few days of life that did nothing more than prolong physical existence for a few more hours or a few more days. Yet, when it was suggested, that doctors be allowed to bill Medicare for conversations with patients about end-of-life care, politicians and others eager to vilify the entire healthcare reform enterprise were able to gain traction by promoting myths about death panels who would travel the country killing off grandma. An irrational discussion of curtailing Medicare expenditures by limiting payment to those treatments shown to be actually effective is shut down by simply crying that one is promoting healthcare rationing. We shall never get to the discussion of how much health care is enough, especially at the end of life. Now, both of these issues present, in my view, classic first principle, seventh principle clashes. At what point must individual freedom and autonomy give way to the wider community? When must our rights as individuals to all the health care we want, whenever we want it, or to keep our money to rather than pay taxes to support universal health care coverage, give way to the moral imperative to care for the least of these, our neighbors? These are ethical debates that we need to have in connection with, not only with health care debate, but also in other areas of public policy. As compared to other so-called developed countries, in particular those in Europe, we fancy ourselves as more religious and suggest that this religious belief somehow makes us superior to those secular others. Yet those countries have made the fundamental moral commitment to universal coverage as a fundamental human right, not dependent upon one's financial or employment status. As Reed points out in his book, the problem is not that the fundamental technical issues of healthcare cannot be resolved. It's not a simple question of single payer versus choice of insurance models. These issues have been addressed in different countries in different ways. None of the solutions in the other systems have been perfect, but with the exception of the approach taken by the United States and a number of third world countries, these other systems have found ways to provide universal coverage that is fair and provides most people with most of the health care that they need. There are ways to provide universal coverage, but we will not do so until we answer the fundamental moral question. How many more Nikki Whites of this country have to die because of complications of the failing American healthcare system before we summon the moral courage to make the changes that are needed? Our closing words this morning are from the Reverend Theodore Parker, a minister in Boston who was famed for keeping a revolver at his desk to protect the slaves that were hiding beneath the basement of his church as part of the Underground Railroad. He says, "Be ours a religion which like sunshine goes everywhere, its temple all space, its shrine this good heart, its creed all truth, its ritual works of love, its profession of faith, divine living. Go in peace. Our worship has concluded. Our service continues."